Thank you, Mark. You already introduced three of, you know, crucial abbreviations for the not completely people in the loop. So this is non-perturbative. That's important. Lorentzian is not abbreviated. It's also important 2D. I work in two dimensions. This is a toy example, and QG is quantum gravity. So I should say this is work done with my student, Jesse von der Dijn, in an archive article that's about to be published, hopefully this week. So here are the various items I'll cover. So the heart of it is really, and new stuff is, you know, about correlators. So what's the larger motivation of this work? Well, let's say the ultimate ambition is to make predictions for early universe cosmology coming from full quantum gravity, okay? Planckian, non-perturbative four-dimensional quantum gravity. And that's, as you well know, that is very challenging for a whole number of reasons. Yeah, first, these are two very different regimes in terms of the physics, the way we describe the theory, and also the nature of the observables, yeah, in these two regimes. So on the one hand, we have non-perturbative Planckian, which we will address by non-perturbative lattice methods, which are primarily numerical. On the other hand, the early universe, well, the best we are able to do is to describe it as, you know, basically fluctuations on a curved background. There are analytical methods that exist there. I have the continuum at my disposal. So it's really a whole different regime, but that applies not just for the you know, the way we describe it, but it reflects, if you like, underlying physics, or that's what we think. So what are natural observables in both frameworks? To the extent we have them, we know it's always a struggle to come up with diffeomorphism invariant quantities, you know, at any scale, but to the extent we have them, there is still a big bridge to gap. So the question is also, what kind of observable could be meaningful in either regime? And that's where we get to correlators. Yeah. So in the first place, I have in mind geometric correlators, where, you know, you just it's to pure gravity for the time being. That's what I look at today. You know, you have just, you know, 2 points, and well, the correlations, of course, capture information about the underlying physics, the underlying geometry. In cosmology, correlators appear all over the place. So, and a very important way we think nowadays about cosmology is if you're looking at slices of constant time and kind of looking at quantum fluctuations on such a classically treated background, and we look how quantum fluctuations in the first place, you know, of some inflaton field behave and how they seed, you know, quantum fluctuations of geometry. And well, if you look in cosmology, a lot of it is just about correlators of this type. So, of course, we'll be talking about this in a very different regime, where also, as we'll see, the correlators have a somewhat different flavor to them. But ultimately, so, as I said, the ambition, and in the best of all worlds, it would be wonderful if you could study correlators, geometric correlators, in a very non-perturbative regime, and somehow derive predictions for cosmology at much lower energy scales from those. So that would be very nice. Do you have an immediate question? Yes.
I have a speech, but I can wait a minute.
A speech, okay. Short speeches are tolerated. Long speeches for after the talk. So the question is, is this a crazy idea? Is this super overambitious? And the answer is, I don't really think so, because from my point of view, there are already a lot of tools in place. There are so there is a, you know, a roadmap. At least we can imagine how this might work. And why is this not totally crazy? Well, within you know, lattice quantum gravity, that's one of the few approaches where we know how to do non-perturbative computations. And if you base it on CDT, causal dynamical triangulations, what we have found, of course, is an emergent universe that is 4D and has certain de Sitter properties. So that's a great starting point. So this is our kind of baby, highly quantum universe. Can we look at properties? Can we look at correlators in this dynamically generated universe and determine their properties? Yeah, to start with. So is that computationally feasible? So that's not a very trivial thing to do. Okay. So I would say, and as you'll see, we have all the ingredients in place. So what I'll talk about today is kind of a two-dimensional proof of principle, which will also show that, well, correlators in gravity are just a little bit different from those you are used to in relativistic quantum field theory on a flat space or on a curved space. And so there are some lessons from this 2D thing, but as I said, in the main part, it's to show, well, this is a feasible program, and of course we want to do this ultimately in higher D. Okay, so let me, this much for the partial motivation. So as a little bit of an introduction to the theme of correlators. So correlators, of course, in many parts of physics play a very essential role. If you're now thinking of relativistic quantum field theory on Minkowski space, yeah, so we write down endpoint functions. Yeah, so take some scalar field phi, right, and we are taking the vacuum expectation value of some monomials of this elementary field, and these are the endpoint functions. So, and why are they so important? Because one can show that in principle all physics can be reconstructed from those. So that's true in a Minkowskian regime. That's also true in a Euclidean regime. Yeah, so these are very important quantities, and of course we compute such things also all the time when we do perturbative quantum field theory, starting with propagators, so two-point functions. So actually, so my theme today will concentrate on two-point functions, okay, as a starting point. They're also being used in a gravity context. So first of all, in perturbative gravity, at least low order in perturbation theory, people study correlators. In cosmology, as I also just mentioned, people also study correlators all the time. So what's the problem? What is the added difficulty in gravity? Well, one of them is maintaining diffeomorphism invariants. So how to extract diffeomorphism invariant information from them? And of course, make these objects themselves into physical quantities. So then that would be implicitly or explicitly diffeomorphism invariant notions of correlators. So how is this done in perturbation theory often? Well, we have the problem, of course, we can gauge fix, right? That's one way. Another thing that's done in cosmology is to do, you know, invoke ideas like relational observables, where you simply express, you know, declare part of your field variable, so that is, you know, g mu nu in one way or other, as your coordinates, and you let the rest of the, you know, field degrees of freedom depend on those. Now, this latter construction, well, this can work classically. It's very, very non-trivial to extend that to the quantum theory. So, I will not talk about this, but what I will talk about is a manifestly diffeomorphism invariant way to look at correlators in a theory of gravity. Yeah. So this will necessarily entail a degree of non-locality. And it, of course, connects to the whole story of, you know, do observables in quantum gravity always have to be non-local? Of course, we already know it's a very difficult thing classically to discuss. And, you know, you may disagree what one can do in classically. I think beyond lowest order perturbation theory, I do see this non-locality popping up everywhere. And I don't exactly see a way around this at all in the quantum theory. But, you know, if you come with a nice proposal for a local quantum observable in non-perturbative quantum gravity, I'm very happy to talk about it. So this non-locality is there, and I would say this is not a bug, it's a feature. Also, of course, it reflects the nature of quantum gravity and quantum geometry on very high scales. Okay, so what I will look at is, generally speaking today, is a diffeo, so a manifestly, I would say, diffeomorphism invariant way of looking at correlators, two-point correlators. And so what are my ingredients? Well, let's assume I have some local geometric operator. Think of it as a curvature invariant. So the simplest one would be kind of the Ricci scalar. Yeah. So, so this is the thing whose correlations I look at. So this is some geometric scalar, classically, or scalar operator from a quantum point of view. And the object I look at, roughly speaking, will look like this. OO, so this is, you know, the correlations of this O to itself, this observable. And there is a geodesic distance R that plays a role here. Then I'm working in a path integral approach. So this is a formal integral over all geometries, G, so equivalence classes of metrics. So if I'm doing Minkowskian, I would have an I, or Lorentzian rather, factors e to the I s of g. And here I'm, m is my underlying manifold, d dx, and just determinantal factors of the determinant of the metric, d dy, g of y, determinants, these are determinants, and O of x, O of y, and then I stick in a delta function here, dg, x and y, minus r. Okay, so this is just my path integral. So this is not, I'm not normalizing this for the time being. Later on I will. This is just the path integral piece, and this is kind of the observable I'm sticking in here. Well, it doesn't depend just on 2 points x and y. But to ensure diffeomorphism invariance, I have to integrate over all x's and y's. And in order not to completely lose track of any interesting information, I require x and y to have a geodesic distance of r. The geodesic distance, for that I use this notation here, yeah, that's of course a geometric quantity. Yeah. So, and this is the r, this is a Dirac delta function. So that ensures me, so that relates to the R dependency on the left-hand side. So this entire construction is geometric. So this is a diffeomorphism invariant observable. Of course, it's very non-local because of these integrals. So, but that's the object we'll study. And I'll show that we can study it in a meaningful way. So this is a geodesic distance.
So in
just a second.
In field theory, that would diverge,
no? But this is a formal expression, okay?
Yeah. No,
it's so, sure. I mean, everything diverges.
You can divide by the volume or something to normalize.
I will show in a second what that's right. It's an unnormalized thing. You know, if I put this on a lattice, on a finite lattice, of course it wouldn't. But yes, you're completely right. Like any other interesting observer in quantum field theory, I'm looking for color. No, I was looking for color show. So this will diverge. Okay, but it deserves, it's important. It's important. No, it doesn't yet deserve a star. Okay, so but this thing is, so note this thing. So this is kind of course interesting and important, which relates to this here. And what we look at instances where now this O will be a notion, a local curvature, which we define in the non-perturbative regime. These kind of, so curvature correlators have been studied before in Euclidean dynamical triangulations back in the 90s, okay? So this was, before this whole causal game came along at all. So there's work by Debucker and Smith from 1995, there's work by Bialas et al. From 1996, who studied this on the lattice. So, Okay, so this would have been a Euclidean version where this is just minus SOT with, I would say, inconclusive results. Okay, it's not a simple thing to measure, but of course there were a number of potential flaws. So number one, I'm doing it in Euclidean, and I don't know in principle what it should have to do with Lorentzian quantum gravity. Another thing is that, well, we are still looking, of course, at indications that, you know, continuum limits can be taken, meaningful continuum limits can be taken in the Euclidean theory. And the last issue is that the notion of curvature that was used there, so whose correlators were looked at, was a kind of registral deficit angle curvature. And this is known to be highly UV divergent. And it's not at all clear that it makes sense to stick it in a correlator like this. Okay, so we'll do better on all of those counts. Lee.
Yes. Do we agree? Let me make a statement and see if you agree. I think that a diffeomorphism invariant observable locates precisely the points at which it's evaluated. And evaluates the points, or it might evaluate the points, by looking at what you see when you look around. In other words, I and you have the same point in terms of diffeomorphism. If I describe what I see,
I would say that what you're alluding to describes a much more complicated situation where I necessarily will have to have observers and other stuff. So this is purely geometric, but nevertheless, I believe there's something to be learned just being purely geometric and taking this, you could say, you know, radical and highly non-local point of view. Okay, but the thing is, we can compute these things, and of course, we can look what interesting information is there. Of course, it doesn't exclude that, you know, there are other ways of, you know, whatever we can learn about observables, I think is good. Okay, now, yes.
So, what's the motivation for putting that delta function?
Yeah. So that it, you see, in order to make a diffeomorphism invariant, I have here these integrals over x and y. Because, well, there's no way, if I don't have matter or anything else or markers in my universe, to say what is x and y. So that wouldn't be diffeomorphism invariant. Of course, I could integrate over all x's and y's, but then, you know, a correlator, it wouldn't depend on anything. Yeah. So to have it depend on a distance, as of course a usual, you know, correlator does, you know, think about this here, right? Let's imagine I'm just doing this. Phi of x1, phi of x2. So if I sit in a Poincaré invariant theory, I know this will be a function of, you know, x1 minus x2, which is, of course, a distance. That's, of course, we are primarily interested in this distance dependence, you know, and how things fall off as we take large distances. Yes?
Just to follow up,
yes.
But you could replace this delta with a Gaussian if that helps calculations for some reasons, right?
No, it does. Okay. You can define many happy families. I will be quite happy with this.
Sometimes it's easier to work with Gaussians than with deltas.
Okay. Okay. Third and last question on this mini topic.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for scalar theory in Minkowskian space, this is the correlator. I mean, it only depends on R.
Oh, I see. So if you do this now for a scalar field in Minkowski, yeah, using the delta there,
and it's
you actually get the guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But then, of course, you know, these are kind of spurious, these integrations, if the space-time looks the same everywhere. So.
Sorry, I still don't understand. Here at R, you're picking an R. But in the field up there, the correlation length,
yeah,
that's the distance.
That's R, yes.
Yeah, this is R. It's what?
It's emergent. It's a quantum thing. Where you compute the correlation function.
Well, I'm just saying, well, of course, you should think of this. That will emerge later. Of course, this is not a classical thing.
Okay, so you're able to show that the delta function.
This is not a classical thing, you know, so it's not a classical exterior parameter, if you like. So, and we'll see that will come, that will be reflected in the nature of the two-point functions. Can I just continue? Because otherwise, it'll be impossible to get to the end of this talk.
So in ordinary space, it is not emergent. I mean, this is R. I mean,
this is R.
But the interpretation,
it's a number.
It's a number.
Yeah, it's not emergent. It's a number.
The Ising model, it is. That's the point.
Yeah, nothing emerges. That is the correct comment.
This is not emergent.
Yes, sir.
Okay. even in the easing model, it's not inversions. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Can I continue? More questions. So let me. Here I'm here. Correlation here. So why would I talk about classical correlators? Well, I tell you what I do on a given manifold. Yeah. This is not an observable that I would typically classically consider, but this is to make sure that it's a diffeomorphism invariant thing of which I then take an ensemble average. Okay, so let me fix the story. So M, this is a Riemannian manifold for the time being because that's what I will be looking at later on. I can only do Riemannian things. So let this be for simplicity compact and Riemannian manifold in principle of any dimension, but for definiteness, let me choose d equal to 2. Okay. So the volume of my manifold M is, of course, in 2D is just this. Yeah. And manifold averages I denote just to fix a notation. Let's see, so that refers to the geometry G, and this is my local quantity. So this is a normalization factor, 1 over volume of M, d to x, square root of g of x. So this is just the manifold average of any quantity. Oh, so with this definition, so what is a classical correlator? So there are no expectation values yet of any kind. I'm sitting on a given M. Okay, so what is this? Well, it depends on the geometry in a diffeo invariant way, I should say. So 01, 02, and on R. So this is d to x, g of x, d to y. So the same I had down there, basically speaking, g of y, 01 of x, 02 of y. So same formula, okay? X, y minus r with this Dirac delta. And this now is important, and it earns itself a star 1. So what can we say about this thing? You know, anyway, it's formal, as Bianca pointed out. Also, when I sit on a compact manifold, well, this will be in general well defined if the O's are nice enough. Okay, so everything will converge. It's invariant. It's symmetric under exchange of those two things. And if I sit on a compact manifold, eventually, if R becomes big enough, this will just vanish, because the manifold runs out of points that are sufficiently far apart, okay? And it's diffeomorphism invariant. So these things I can say about it as a general matter of fact. Would I be interested in on a general manifold, classically from kind of GR point of view? Well, I don't see why necessarily. But nevertheless, let us look at this object a little closer. So let me look at specific case. So what I can do, I can make a simple choice for these two operators. Let them both be 1, not operators, functions of the metric. Yeah? So they are certainly scalars, so that's fine. So what do we get here? So this is the g of 1, 1, and r. Okay, let me just put this in here, write this out again, g d to y square root g. So I have just an O. Oh, sorry, no, I don't have an O, not a single O. This is just a delta function, y minus r. So what can I do here? Well, I can do this integral. For a given point x, this just gives me the volume of a circle of radius r around x. Okay? So this is simply d to x square g, volume. So this is how I denote it. This is a circle of radius r based at x. Okay. Now this thing I integrate over the manifold. So I'm taking its manifold average, right? Keeping in mind this definition here, this is the same as volume m times the average of this object in the geometry G. I hope you agree. So let us look at one other case where, well, only O2 is equal to 1. So what do we get then? So it's another interesting subcase. So this is O1 of R. And OK, so obviously, so I get, let's say the O stays here, right? I still get this volume factor here. So let me just skip one intermediate step. So this is just d2x square root of g of x volume of s x r. Okay, so what is this? Well, it's a little bizarre thing. So I'm integrating over x. So right, so here is my point x where my O lives, my observable. But then I'm giving this a kind of a non-local weight factor, which is the volume of the sphere of radius r. Okay. That's what that is. So let me now, I'm still classical. I'm still on a given manifold. So what is now a connected correlator?
Are you assuming some trivial topology? Or by this S, you mean not really a sphere, but whatever complicated object you get up in general?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's correct. Yeah, yeah. So of course, it will only be for infinitesimal. X, you will be assured that it's a sphere. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Just the set of all points, you know, at this distance. Exactly. Very good comment. Yes, excellent. So, yes?
How wild is that? Yes. How wild is that?
Oh, that can get arbitrarily wild on a general.
How do you know that that's computable?
Huh?
How do you know that that's computable?
Because, well, it's clearly computable for sufficiently small r. Right, but I will just compute it in my later on. I mean, this is a motivation, of course, for computations I'm going to do on the lattice. And there, yeah, I can simply do the computation. Okay. Now,
isn't it very ultraviolet? So for example, more ultraviolet and lattice, smaller and smaller lattice spacings.
Well, you see, well, you know, of course, it does depend on O of x. So, yeah. But again, you know, I have computed it in 2D on the lattice, and everything is hunky-dory, as we'll see. So what is a connected correlator? Well, what do we do? Well, we're not just interested in the correlation of the fields, but we correlate the fluctuations of the field around the mean. Now, that's what we're correlating. So here, what would be this, you know, be the case here for this kind of classical correlator? I call this GC, G of O1, O2. R. Now, this is d2x square root g, d2y another square root g, and now we have O1 of x minus, and now here this is my notation, the notation I introduced up there. This is the manifold mean of O1, and then I have the same for O2. 2 of y minus O2. Manifold mean G in G. Okay, let me rewrite this. So this is a G without the C, O1, O2 of R, right? This is just this guy, minus, of course, the manifold averages pull out. Yeah? So here I get a next term, O1 bar G, 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 and now we get these terms with O1, O, and 1, 1. And another term of this type is O2 bar in G, 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 O1, 1 of R plus, and now we have two times manifold averages for O1 and O2, G, times G 1 1 R. So now you see why I introduced these special cases.
Yeah.
Now, so this is again, this is a diffeomorphism. Everything is diffeomorphism invariant by construction. Yeah. So the interesting thing I would want to highlight are these guys. Oops. I call the kind of mixed terms. See, I've pulled out one of them, but they are residual correlations of what? Well, it seems like, you know, the O2 with the 1, or the O1 with the 1. So in general, as you'll see, they are non-vanishing, and also they do not factorize. So, so let me illustrate this by the following, by looking at a special case for which they factorize and for which everything looks familiar. The special case is assume the geometry is constant. Okay? What do I mean by that? Well, it's, let's take it to be G to be maximally symmetric, right? Round sphere, piece of hyperbolic space, you know, some flat torus, something like this. Okay, so let's assume, so suppose G is maximally symmetric. What happens to these quantities? Well, it's fairly straightforward to see. So if we look at G, G01 of R, which is here. If the geometry looks the same everywhere, then of course the volume of the sphere will look the same in every point, so it will not depend on it. I can just pull it out of this integral. Okay. So what this is, in this case, is vol SR, I don't have to give it an X, D2X square root GOX. So this I can simply rewrite as volume of SR times volume of the manifold times the manifold average. Sorry?
Something really foundational. In addition, like the axiom of choice.
In what step?
You know, you said that you're counting, and you're throwing out structure, and you really need to still have things to count. So if you were an intuitionistic logician, would you draw out different things?
I don't know. This is just a calculation. This is just a calculation in classical. In classical Riemannian geometry.
Okay. When you did that factorization you just did.
But I'm not doing any. This is just a property that you will find satisfied for G maximally symmetric. So I don't see any philosophical subtleties in this, but maybe I misunderstand you. So let me just continue the argument a little. So what is this guy here? When I have one in both arguments. Well, it was this thing here, where I'm not can just pull out again by the same argument the volume of the sphere, SR times vol M. Now let us see. Therefore, in this particular case, so what is the connected correlator of O1, O2, assuming these O's are sufficiently nice for me to do the calculation. So the thing is, you see, so that there's a de facto factorization of these pieces here in such a way that these three last terms, they're all identical, apart from the pluses and minus signs. So two of them cancel, and what is left is just this one here. O1, O2, R minus volume M, volume of SR, O1G, O2G. Now here, now, so that's clear. So a very natural normalization suggests itself at this stage, which is normalization by this object here. So, so what does it? What does it present? Well, I get to that in a second. So normalization with me is a tilde, okay? So don't, I hope you don't get confused by now by all my And so this is just division of the same object without the tilde, O1, O2, by the corresponding GG 1, 1 of R. Okay. So So this can be, if you like, what this can be thought of, but it is much more concrete once you get to a discretization. This is really kind of, you count, but here, of course, in the continuum sense, the number of all point pairs that live in your manifold that happen to have distance r. Okay? And since these objects all are measurements that are taken for such point pairs, I would claim this is a very natural way to normalize things. So if I then re-examine this equation here, then I get to a normalized connected propagator O1, O2 of R that looks, that is, well, the G tilde G of O1, O2 of R. And here, so this is just this guy, but this, of course, it is itself already G11, so this drops out. So minus O1 G bar minus O2 G bar. And of course, this looks much more like a familiar propagator, right? So here I just subtract the product of the means. So, but the point is, already here, of course, on a general manifold, well, it will not be maximally symmetric. And the very same thing will happen when we evaluate this quantity in the quantum theory. Because there, of course, geometry is dynamical, so G will fluctuate. So automatically, these terms, well, as I said, will not only, of course, be non-zero, but that's not so much the point, but they will not factorize in general. So these unfamiliar terms are due to geometry by being dynamical. And of course, especially in the case of non-perturbative geometry, fluctuations will in general be large. So these will in general be very relevant terms to consider. And that's certainly the case in this 2D thing I'm looking at here.
Quick verification. You're calling volume S is not the intrinsic volume of these spheres either, right? It's you're calling, just to make sure I'm...
Well, it's just whatever, you know, if
some quantity associated to this sphere.
On a continuum manifold, this will not be a single S1, but it will typically fall into multiple components.
No, but even if it's just one component, it's not the intrinsic volume, right?
It is intrinsic, it's the induced volume with respect to the metric G.
You don't have the induced metric that appears in the volume.
What?
The full space-time metric, so to speak.
Yeah, but it's induced, it's a volume in this metric.
Yeah, but this came from the induced, this came, there was a delta function here.
Yeah, it's the function that tells you where you're integrating, but there's nothing that tells you that you have to take the determinant of the induced metric as opposed to the determinant of the ambient metric. So in that sense, I'm saying this volume S doesn't seem to be the intrinsic volume.
No, it's
some number you're associating.
No, it's intrinsic volume. I would claim it's really the intrinsic volume induced by G on the submanifold.
But do you agree that you should change the determinant to the determinant of the induced metric? Or not the same?
No, but here, this is the integral. Yeah, but this is the delta function.
Yes, which tells you where you're integrating, but nobody's switching this determinant of the 2D metric to the determinant of the 1D induced metric that you need in order to talk about the intrinsic volume.
Well, I think this is the same, but let's argue about this later. Okay, so this is a special case, okay? So maximally symmetric, so yeah. And then we retrieve something that we know and love. So I can say something in 5 minutes about the CDT setting, QRC, before showing you actually, so what are the results when we measure them in Monte Carlo simulations, okay? So just for the people who are not so familiar with this whole story, so this is kind of CDT in two dimensions in a nutshell. So a portant is non-perturbative, it's Lorentzian, it's a path integral, which we are regularizing, and whose continuum limit we look at. That's an analytically soluble model, a toy model of full quantum gravity. And the ingredients are the following. little triangles we all know and love. So they have edge length squared, alpha squared, minus alpha, so a squared, sorry, that's the a is a kind of lattice spacing. So they have two time-like edges. Alpha is a some real number that's larger than zero. And a just sets the size of the thing. By definition, the interior is flat. So this is a Minkowskian triangle, the flat matrix. So if I wanted to, I could draw the light cones inside everywhere. Now, this is our elementary building block. From those, we generate two-dimensional curved piecewise flat geometries, which are the objects we will integrate over in the path integral. And the way you know we do this is by sticking these objects together so that the space-like things always fall. So this there's a kind of time direction. So where time is in steps, in integer steps, 0, 1, 2, 3, etc. These are all spatial, and we fill in the spaces here with triangles of this type I do there. Well, I could make more an effort than I would, you know, draw whatever, these blue and these red to distinguish space and time-like. But let me just keep things simple for the time being. Okay. So at each moment in time, so what we're doing for simplicity, so this is space, the horizontal directions, we cyclically identify the left and the right. So we have a kind of we have a cylinder, right? And at each time, there is some length of the spatial universe. That's also an integer. So this is L of 1. This is here 2. And 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. L of 3 is 5. So we have a universe that whose volume or length in this very simple case changes, can change as a function of time, basically to anything. Every distinct geometry as a gluing of these objects kind of appears with the same weight, essentially, in the path integral. Yeah, the weight depends on the Einstein action. And the whole objects we look at are then these kind of candlestick objects. You know, if you look at them from a somewhat larger scale, and what we do here, so this is an in loop and an out loop, we also identify those. So we have an overall topology. We are working with, somewhat for simplicity, S1 cross S1. So we are cyclically identifying the time, and we have spatially closed universes that are S1s. Okay, whoops. So that's a general story. So here are all my individual slices. And yeah, so I have gluing rules. And these here ensure kind of global hyperbolicity. It's a longer story, and I don't repeat it here. So this is an example of a typical triangulation that will contribute to the path integral. What is it characterized by? Well, by the volume, N2 of T. So it's the number of triangles in T. So it's a kind of discrete volume. And how do we measure lengths and distances in terms of the geodesic link distance? So so link distance is d of xy. X and y are points on the vertices of the lattice. So this is defined by the number of links in the shortest path from x to y. Okay, so we have volumes and distances, and that turns out basically all we need to know. So the path integral is very simple. We have a fixed topology. We are in two dimensions. So kind of the Einstein-Hilbert action. There's a topological term, the full integral over the curvature. And what is left here is a sum over all in this overall triangulations, which are with a measure factor that measures the size of the automorphism group of a given causal dynamical triangulation T, which is almost always 1. And then we have what is left over of the Einstein-Hilbert action with a cosmological term. We have just this cosmological term, and this is the bare cosmological constant. So That is the path integral at the regularized level, hopefully somewhat familiar. And the way we compute expectation values, right, is by normalizing with Z, sum over T, 1 over C of T, O of T, e to the minus lambda, and 2 of T. And what we factually do in almost all simulations we do, we run the simulations in a constant volume ensemble. So where we're keeping N2 fixed, but then we systematically, whatever observable we study, we then increase N2 and by, you know, finite size scaling methods try to extrapolate to the real physical limit of N2 to infinity, okay, with keeping a finite physical volume fixed. And so we are running Monte Carlo, Markov chain, Monte Carlo simulations in the fixed volume limit, fixed volume ensemble, not limit, ensemble. And what we have used in what I'm going to show you is N2 between 50k, so 50,000 simplices or triangles, and 300,000k. So that's already kind of decent sizes for this type of study. And what we also do, you see, well, these they can be very become very thin, these things. So we are avoiding these regions, and we are doing measurements only in places where we don't get finite size effect from things wrapping around. So we make sure that, you know, these are not too don't become too thin, that we can make, I mean, we're always fixing the total number of time slices, again, for given triangulations. And we don't make that too large compared to the volume. So these extreme things do not happen or happen very rarely. So that is the setup.
Is this related to what the
descriptive?
There are various new style magics, intuitionistic magic.
Okay.
Where they continue to have different measures.
Different measures, you say?
Measures.
I'm not sure I understand the comment fully, but what I'm doing here, well, you know, we cannot really lead a very educated discussion on it. This here is here. If you can look at it in a very profane way, say I try and avoid finite size effect. I'm not interested in what happens, you know, because my simulations are all finite and I cannot avoid running into these things. I try and get rid of them. I analyze where they are and I throw out the data that are associated with them. So, to give you something that we believe is more reflective of continuum behavior. But of course, one is making choices in doing this. Okay.
How many configurations do you have to throw out to avoid these?
Well, you make, as I said, we choose a fixed relation, roughly speaking, of the average L and the T tot. I mean, there are various ways of doing this. So that is kind of roughly square. But we know there are large deviations from the average. And we look for individual, you can either do it at the level of individual measurements or at the level of configurations. One can do various things, and we have tried various things but to control these. But it can be done. It was also done in previous study. Well, then you're mixing, you know, the global features with what we think, you know, should maybe be essentially local. Well, of course, you know, there's always an issue of, you know, what's local and what's global here, especially in the theory, which is just purely quantum. Yeah. But anyway, this is a choice we made. So I'm just telling you, this is a choice. If you make other choices, if you make them extremely long, then you will things will behave differently. And we can discuss whether that's interesting or not. Okay, just I need a little, tiny little space to explain. Just so you understand what the curvature notion is, and then I show you the results. So what was, as I said, I already briefly mentioned, that this kind of the deficit angle curvature is highly divergent in four dimensions. That's what one has found in dynamically triangulated models. Maybe not so surprisingly, but this quantum Ricci curvature here is better behaved in the UV, and we have already explicitly tested it, including in four dimensions. So it's, you know, concerns about things become very divergent are absolutely justified. But this is a notion that seems to work okay. So just briefly, just to recap in 5 minutes before showing you the results. So the setting is again a Riemannian manifold. So to introduce it, it's very straightforward to show you what it's on a nice manifold, but it applies on the piecewise flat objects that are putting the path integral, and that's a beauty. And further on, you know, the beauty is it works on general metric spaces like the ones we have, and yeah, it gives good results on Riemannian manifolds. It gives results compatible with the continuum, and what one does is the following. So the main idea is, sorry, they should be of equal size. I'm in my manifold M. I'm choosing two geodesic balls around a point P and P prime as P, SP of radius delta, SP prime of radius delta, and they have a geodesic distance epsilon, okay? So this radius is delta, this radius is delta. And the essential idea behind this quantum Ricci curvature is to compare the distance of the centers between a suitably defined distance between those two spheres. Let me call this d bar. And the point is, so that the motivation is transparent and certainly true in the continuum. So roughly speaking, on a flat manifold, d bar would be equal to epsilon. On a curved manifold, it depends on the Ricci curvature associated with that direction. If that Ricci curvature is positive, then d bar will be smaller than epsilon. And conversely, if the Ricci curvature is negative, it will be larger than epsilon. And this is what one uses then as a motivation to use this in a more general context, where here, you know, of course, on this is on a smooth manifold. I have full tensor calculus. I can, for infinitesimal epsilons and delta, I just can do this computation and see what it gives me to low order. But the idea that comes actually from mathematics, so it's been inspired by constructions, in pure mathematics, where people study curvature on general metric spaces, non-smooth spaces, it comes from this Olivier curvature. We need something slightly more. We are looking at limits, you know, continuum limits, and why the mathematicians, they are not specifically interested in our limit. But so the additional information I'm giving you is that in the quantum gravity limits, the type of limits we are taking, the notion of curvature that this gives rise to seems to be have a better UV behavior than the virtual one.
Okay. So these have to do with measures and practice.
Not necessarily fractal, but the only thing you need are volume measurements. So you need to have the space to have a measure and distance measurements. And that comes with the metric.
So there is a field of mathematics called, interestingly enough, Polish geometry.
Exactly. Yeah, these are Polish, exactly. They're Polish metric spaces. Exactly. So it basically means you have a measure and you have a metric. Yeah, a distance, a notion of distance. So what is our notion of d bar for two spheres, sp, sp prime, delta, delta? It's the following thing. So that's our specific way of implementing it. So there is a double normalization factor of the volumes of the two spheres with respect to the induced metric. And we have here, if you are in d dimensions, we have sphere integrals. And now this is induced metric on the first sphere, d minus 1, q prime, h prime on the second sphere. And we have again d g q prime. So this time, yeah, Simona should be happy, at least, dg So where, so what do we do? We fix the centers to be epsilon apart, and here we just integrating over all pairwise distances. Okay, and then yeah, so that's a natural kind of way to normalize this. And then basically what we're looking at is we are we're taking d bar depends on the so. Yeah, no. So what we're doing, we look at the special case that epsilon is zero, because we're not interested in the full Ricci curvature, but only the Ricci scalar. Okay? So what we are then computing is the sphere distance of the sphere to itself. But it still turns out it contains all the information about the Ricci scalar that you want. So what do we do then? We divide d bar of sp of delta 2 itself over all these point pairs with this definition and divide it by delta to normalize it. So that's the leading, so that becomes now a delta, or it's a delta of this radius. And this is now, so if you do this, if you look at what this is in the continuum for small delta, then you'll find that this is 4 divided by pi minus delta squared 9 pi r of p plus higher order delta terms, delta cubed, excuse me. So what one does in these quantum applications, one just says, okay, it's a constant plus some stuff. And you don't, of course, you cannot really perform a delta expansion. That doesn't even make sense. But you lump all of these things together and you say, this is my kind of my quantum Ricci curvature. And the immediate thing, qualitatively, this is something you can just measure, because you can measure this on the lattice, you can measure this on the lattice, and you monitor it as a function of delta. And that's what we do in 2D in the model. And then we look at deviation from constancy. So if we measure this thing on the lattice as a function of the sphere size delta, and it just gives a straight line, then we say, OK, that looks like a zero curvature, like a flat space, according to this QRC definition. If it deviates, if it becomes smaller, it drops below constancy, then we say, aha, there must have been a positive. Yeah. So okay, even before coming to kind of quantitative measures, it gives us a qualitative measure. Is curvature vanishing, positive or negative? And when we draw this in 2D, d bar divided by delta, if you do this in the case here for 2D CDT, what we are finding is a curve that looks like this as a function of delta. So there is some initial finite size, I mean, not finite size, discretization artifact. And then it's a curve that kind of gently slopes up. So this is a curvature observer where we look at. Then we probe, we measure this, of course, locally. So this is the ensemble average. We measure this locally at a region of between kind of 5 and 20, where we trust the data that come from the lattice. And for fixed delta, we take this as indicative of local curvature. And this is quantity whose correlators we look at. And this is now my, I need my.
Can I have a small question? So this delta equals 20, is that still in the regime where you know that the delta cubed terms are subdominant over the delta squared terms?
I don't care. I don't care. I lump these together.
But then how do you know whether curvature is, like,
well,
the delta cubed term, this is not what you would call the curvature, right? I mean, or
well, of course, if you do this in the continuum, of course, there will be higher order terms coming in.
Right.
But you always know that kind of the leading deviation from constancy will be determined, you know, by that next term. Okay. So that's the logic. Okay, but does everyone see this?
Do you need this black dot, or is it sufficient?
No, I only need maybe those, yeah, these formulas may be handy. Okay. Okay, so here, so these are the correlators I defined. These are not the connected correlators. That's before we do the subtraction. So it's a correlator of this quantity I just told you, this quantum Ricci curvature. At, you know, in the curve, as we say, we probe this at various, so it has a non-trivial dependence on that. We probe it at various fixed delta. So this is just the quantity we correlate then over some R range. So this is R. Here is the plot for given deltas. This is done for maximal 300k volume. But it looks, I mean, very similar for lower volumes. So what we are seeing here is the following. So what is this R max? This is a, R max is a, what we've estimated that, you know, the region below R max is free of finite size effect. It turns out to be quite conservative, but anyways, this is what it is. So trust, we're trusting these data. These, for different deltas, what is delta? Delta was the size of these balls. So what we are now doing, we are considering correlators where the two spheres coincide of radius delta. I compute curvature here, d bar divided by delta. And then I have another double sphere here. And this is R. And those are these have delta. So whenever R is smaller than two delta, then these two spheres overlap. And in that region, because the curvature depends on the data within that radius, naturally there will be correlations, because it's just computed from the same data. Okay? So this is what, for a given color, these vertical bars are. This indicate where R inside here, the two balls overlap, or the two disks inside these circles, or whatever they are. So here we see correlations. There's some peak in this region. Then it kind of gently slopes, and well, whatever happens here. So this is the first part of the correlator. Now let's look at the next one, where we have here a curvature and here a 1. Okay. Oops, that looks almost the same. OK, slightly different scales before this from the previous slides, like 1.5. But these shapes look at least qualitatively very similar. I get some peaks in these regions of overlaps. Then I get some fall-offs. And now here, this illustrates something what I said earlier, which is now on the vanishing blackboard. So remember, this is the normalized guy. And well, the argument I gave earlier is that this quantity generally doesn't factorize into this term times that term. And that's exactly what we see here. Because if it did factorize, then the curves should just look like constants. But you see here very significant differences. Okay, so this is a curvature 1 correlator. So what is correlating here? Well, what's correlating is the d bar by delta with the r, in a sense. Okay, so that's what connects me to this other point. So it's the r dependence that comes in here. Now let's look at the connected correlator, where, you know, I had the full formulas on one of the blackboards. Here is again, so the connected correlator for my curvature observable, not observable, variable. And so I can split it up in these two terms, in these three terms. Since O1 and O2 are now the same, I get two what I before called mixed terms of the same type. So you see, that's what this quantity is. And here is what the result is of these addition and subtractions. We see a correlator that as soon as we go outside the regions where these balls overlap, is just identically zero. I mean, very convincingly. So we have here an almost perfect cancellation. And it goes far beyond the region where we thought, okay, we may pick up finite size effect. So what we see down here, these are definitely finite size effects from the finiteness of these torus directions. Yeah? But here we see in a whole range, and for any value of delta, the same picture. Okay. So that's the final result. So is that good or bad? Well, it's good for various reasons. So it shows you, so we have now these local curvature quantities, but there are no correlations. Okay. So it's not so surprising. In two-dimensional quantum gravity, there are no propagating degrees of freedom. So we don't expect to see correlations of any kind. Okay. So that's fine. What it also shows us is that this, you know, diffeomorphism invariant construction we made seems to be sensible, works, gives a sensible result. Okay, so that's definitely also good. So, and it's also a bit of a test for, yeah, this curvature. In a more technical sense, the curvature, the quantum Ricci curvature, is quite computationally intensive. Okay, so, but we could do this computation and come up with quite convincing result. So we are reassured by this story that it does make sense from a technical and a theoretical point of view. This is maybe not the only way to compute connected correlators, but it's kind of fully diffeomorphism invariant. There's a quantitative output. And so, of course, this is what we also would like to do in higher dimensions. So that's the story of the day. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Renata. We have over time, but we have time for a couple of questions.
When you define the correlator and stuff, you were working in the Euclidean case, and then somehow you swap to the Lorentzian case?
No, everything. Everything, all the explicit calculation, of course, I do in with the Monte Carlo method. They have to be in the Euclidean regime. So I only briefly said, I should have said, it was written in my note, I wick-rotate, and this is what I meant to write, by, you know, mapping alpha to minus alpha in the lower half complex alpha plane, and then I end up with a Euclidean model who's where I now use a partition function and I compute expectation values in that ensemble.
And this notion of discounting links refers to this Euclidean setting, not to the Lorentzian.
It refers to the Euclidean setting, yeah, indeed. Yes.
Well, as an outsider, I can understand something. Thanks.
Yes.
I have a short question. You said that 1 plus 1 dimensional reactivity is topological, so not propagating.
It's not. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, continue.
So can you get information about the topological degree of freedom from this correlator behavior?
Yeah, so I wouldn't. So the way I would phrase it is that, well, we fixed the topology here. So you could say, well, why is that an interesting model at all? Of course, classically, it's not at all an interesting model because there is not even a kinetic term in the Lagrangian. So there are no classical solutions. There is nothing. But of course, people have studied it both in Euclidean and, like me here, in the Lorentzian signature as toy models of quantum geometry. And you can write down the path integral, and it's perfectly non-trivial, even if you fix the overall topology. Yeah.
Presumably, if you change the topology, the plots will change. So there is some information about the topology that you can learn.
I don't expect the local degrees of freedom to be correlated just because I changed the topology.
No, I don't mean that the degrees of freedom of topology will be correlated. No, that you expect.
Yeah.
It's just that these correlators will depend on the topology. I mean, for instance, where your spheres start intersecting, it will depend on the topology.
There will be some, and especially, of course, there are two things. Of course, I can repeat the same thing for fixed different topologies. And then, very well, because also one shouldn't imagine these as kind of, imagine I now look at not just kind of these toroidal things, but let me just take some whatever genus G surface. Of course, the quantum geometries, they will not look like nice, you know, like we see genus G surfaces drawn in the book. They will have that topology by construction, but they will look completely wild. So these, you know, these holes may be anywhere. Yes, Jan, you want to say something?
I'll just add to this that, of course, in Euclidean 2D quantum gravity, you can calculate correlators also of matrices, conformal pieces. And the point is, of course, that all properties of these correlators, local properties, do not depend on topology. All the critical exponents are the same independent topology. But of course, if you start to integrate correlators, it will depend. There will be something different.
But these correlators here, I got the impression that they know about also the topology. Maybe I'm wrong. But you see, they're defined as an integral everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
So now, depending on the topology.
Yeah. So again. Again, we cannot in a very clean, especially in these are super quantum fluctuating. So there is no very clean way of distinguishing between local and global, I'd say. And yet another question would be, okay, if we include sums over topologies, but then we know anyway, we get into trouble for other reasons. So this is not what I'm discussing here. In that sense, topological information is buried in here. Although here I tried to get, to get rid of it as much as possible.
But again, in 2D imaging, you can check this when you add conformal fields and use this definition, and then you see for small r.
No, for large r, it will. Small r, of course, you won't see.
No, for small r. For large r.
But this is, as long as r is. But we have never seen any dependence on topology.
Oh, I see.
Except if you start to integrate.
I see, I understand.
Yes.
Impossible. So, is this result analytically continued back to real time? So, you said that you didn't rotate, right?
Well, some general properties fall of behavior, one would expect to be actually quite robust.
Yeah.
Just looking at also even at standard correlators, in the continuum. So, it being zero, I would be pretty certain that this is can be. Zero will not become non-zero. I mean, will not become non-zero upon.
No, of course.
At least I don't see a mechanism for this doing. But in general, detailed properties. I mean, functional properties. But we are studying. Imagine we do this in four dimensions, right? Of course, these are not an analytical, what you will be able to do is maybe look at fall-off behaviors, right? So, a detailed, in higher dimensions, detailed analytical control of the functional properties will just not be possible. So you will anyway only be reduced, to some kind of essential information.
But the reason I ask is because also, when you go from Euclidean to Lorentzian, r equals zero behaves.
No. One would have to. That's right. And what happens to the light cone? These are kind of subtle things. But again, this would say, okay, if I had now complete analytical control, what now happens if I, analytically continue a suitable variable, that appears in my correlators, but we don't have that explicit control. So the information indeed about Lorentzian will always be somewhat indirect. On the basis of these data, what can we make any statements in the Lorentzian sector? Yeah. And that's generally difficult.
So I'm interested in, I guess in the end, you want to relate your early universe correlator to CMB observations, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you proceed to do that? Would you what assumptions do you take on the history of the universe? Is there anything you have to assume, or how would you proceed to do that?
Well, I would very naively just start by, looking at our kind of de Sitter-shaped objects and trying to understand whether it's meaningful to, in maybe some thickened kind of constant time slices, to repeat this type of computation.
Mm-hmm.
And whether one sees any meaningful signal, of course, these universes are not super big, but in the best of all worlds, I can say something about, say, curvature-curvature correlators in slices of constant time. This is, of course, a super non-perturbative regime.
Mm-hmm.
And can it really be compared to, what's on the market is, of course, this is, of course, very weak, it's perturbative. Small quantum fluctuations on the background. So, but that's the direction we are going.
So So you would compute the primordial power spectrum at adding at the end of inflection.
Yeah, of course, power spec. Of course, one makes many assumptions. Where a test in order to see that it's meaningful, and something we also started doing, is to understand to what extent can these, you know, the 4D universe or the 3D slices be considered homogeneous and isotropic at all. So, because otherwise one can just, you know, make formal, oh, you know, blindly compute some correlator and then hope it will relate to something we compute in perturbation theory. But you could say, well, what is the reason why? You know, if you're very far away from any regime of approximate homogeneity, that's, what's the sense of this? So that's part of the package of things one still has to check. So that's, of course, not the only observable. But that's the basic idea. OK, you had another question?
Yes, I think we're going to spike.
OK.
I think the math is also still around.
I'm still around, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
OK. Thank you for.
Thanks a lot, Renata.
Thanks for being here.